really curious what your chair feels like.
Your chair's so bad, honestly.
At some point, I want to try that. By the way, if you're just listening to this, Mariana, who's senior at the BBC to me, has a giant, luscious chair, and I have a tiny pink one that forces me into the fetal position. You're chair-mogging me. And if you don't know what chair-mogging means, you have to listen to our previous episode, the first episode of Top Comment, where we discuss clavicular.
We also spoke all about this concept of decline porn, and I tracked down this guy who's made these AI-generated videos of Croydon in South London. Now, in response to our episode, he has actually made a new video, an AI-generated video showing roadmen, as he calls them, taking over the BBC.
What, just like storming into
the BBC? Yeah, storming the BBC, climbing around on the on like the news sort of desk, everything.
Flip it, fam. So, for people who don't know us, obviously you're the BBC's kind of in-house disinformation expert.
Yeah.
I'm an investigative journalist, and I think that last episode and those two stories give you a very good flavour as to the kind of stories we'll be doing.
Exactly. This podcast, the whole point of it is to investigate and analyse what is popping up on your social media feed and why, which Matt and I spend our day-to-day doing a lot. You can go back and listen to the episode we were discussing in this feed, episode one. For episode two, what have we got on the agenda, Matt?
So the first thing we're going to talk about is the rise and rise of prediction markets. So you've probably seen Polymarket and Kalshi, the two famous prediction market websites, popping up on your feed. We're going to talk about what's really behind them and why they may not be all that they seem.
And we're going to be talking all about anti-vax, the rise of anti-vax, or maybe the emboldening is the right word, on social media, and how that is contributing to and inflaming real world stuff, including outbreaks of diseases in the UK and in the US as well. You might have seen this stuff coming up in the comments or in other places. So we're going to get into all of that. And we could not do this episode without talking about a certain baby monkey, which if you have spent any time on social media this week, you will have struggled to avoid: baby punch. Okay, so we've just found out that Kalshi, which is one of these prediction market sites companies, has decided to fine, a $20,000 fine, someone called Artem Kaptur, who allegedly placed bets based on, quote, material non-public information that he got by working as a video editor for one of the world's most famous YouTubers, Mr. Beast. This is a big deal, and I guess the place to start is, what is Kalshi? What are prediction markets? What are we talking about here?
Okay, so a quick explainer on what prediction markets are. They're online betting markets where you can bet money on the outcome of real world events. If you go on the two most famous websites, Polymarket and Kalshi, right now, you can see bets for things like...
Should I get it up? I'll get Polymarket up.
You can usually bet on anything like the outcome of wars that are going on right now, when Israel will strike Iran, when the US will strike Iran.
Yeah, so it's got US strikes Iran by, and then it's got two different dates, March 31st and March 14th. There's some random stuff as well, like will the US confirm that aliens exist before 2027?
What are the odds on that?
It's 16% chance, yes or no, and the volume is $9 million. I'm going to say no to that. I'm joking.
Well, Trump has said he's going to...
That is true.
...do something true about aliens. And some of the stuff tips into slightly grotesque betting, arguably. Like, you can bet on specific outcomes in the ongoing Ukraine war, and you can bet on whether Israel will bomb Gaza. You can bet on the outcomes of court cases. You can bet on whether some random celebrity is going to appear at the Super Bowl. You can bet on pretty much anything. Anyone can put a bet on there. So Kalshi and Polymarket, they are valued at $8 billion and $11 billion each. So tons of money is being traded on these platforms. Both have struck deals with major US news organizations, CNBC, CNN. So you may now see the betting odds of certain news events like elections on the ticker in American news.
In a quick disclosure, we should tell you that CNBC and Kalshi have a commercial relationship that includes CNBC having a minority investment in that company. And of course, we run lots of different Kalshi data on our screen and discuss it.
And we can talk a little bit about the regulatory framework around these websites in a bit. But I think one really interesting thing that most people don't know about prediction markets is the kind of philosophical idea behind them. So it comes out of this rationalist movement within Silicon Valley. And what they believe is that if you aggregate enough information from betting markets and if people are staking their own money on those bets, you essentially create the most accurate predictor of the future, a kind of crystal ball. And Shane Copeland...
So they're almost like polling, essentially. Like,
yeah, they're more accurate than polling.
And is that because of the sheer number of people that get involved and have a stake in it, I guess?
It's because of that. It's also because, like you said, they have a stake in it, so they're... because
they want to be right.
Their belief, their rationalist belief is if you are betting your own money on something, then you are going to be accurately saying what you think will happen rather than polling, which is less accurate.
Or like, maybe involved. I think this, maybe I... yeah.
But the other reason it's more accurate is because of insider betting. So it arguably benefits the founders of these companies in their quest to create a kind of crystal ball if people with privileged information as to what will happen in a news event, say it's will the US strike Iran, for example, if they bet on it, that brings the betting odds closer to the actual probability of an event happening. Not to go down too deep of a rabbit hole, but to give you a little bit of idea of the history of this, the guy who kind of invented this is a guy called Robin Hanson, the father of prediction markets. And he actually got DARPA, the US Defense Research Agency, to fund one of his projects called the Policy Analysis Market. And the plan was to create prediction markets that would help predict events in the Middle East. It was dubbed the terror market. Now, this project was scuttled in 2003. Why do you think the terror market was cancelled?
Because it will encourage people to carry out attacks.
Exactly. So they quickly figured out if we start letting people bet on terrorism in the Middle East, people might do terrorism to make money on those bets.
Yeah, and then bet on it themselves. And so if for example, a politician were to bet on an event where they kind of know what the outcome might be because they are party to privileged information, you'd get in trouble for that, wouldn't you? Like, that's insider trading. Yeah.
It's insider betting. And there is a difference. And the regulatory situation is difficult. So in the UK...
you can't use these websites, can you? They're right. Basically blocked. And say in places like France, that's also the case. Belgium, that's also the case. In the Netherlands, they now call this unlicensed betting. You can look at the website, like I'm able to look on my phone, but I can't participate, basically. And then there are some... so Polymarket is the one we were talking about, which is outside of the US. Kalshi is the one that's like very US-centric and focused. And there are quite a lot of places working out how to deal with this. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it, Matt? Because it's not dealt with like betting on sports, like betting on a football game or a soccer game or whatever the right American sport you want to bet on is. What's the best way of defining how it's regulated?
Well, yeah, a commodity is a kind of financial investment that works on the prediction of the future of a market, whereas a security is like an actual bit of investment, like a stock, for example.
Yeah.
And in the US, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is the body that regulates this, which means that they see it as a commodity. But the history of the regulation is kind of interesting. So initially, the CFTC was very much against this. Under Biden, they fined Polymarket $1.4 million and blocked Americans from trading on the platform. Then there was a lawsuit later that Kalshi won, paving the way for these prediction markets to continue.
And Donald Trump's administration had a very sort of different approach to this.
I think it's fair to say that, yeah. So the prediction markets predicted Trump to win, both Kalshi and Polymarket. But yeah, just to give you an idea of like how things have changed for these companies, Shane Copeland, the guy who founded Polymarket, who's 27 years old, he's now a billionaire, he basically was raided by the FBI as part of an investigation. At the time, under the Biden administration, Polymarket claimed the raid was political and was basically retaliation for its users betting overwhelmingly that Donald Trump would win the election. He did win the election. That investigation was later dropped. Kalshi also named Donald Trump Jr. as a paid advisor, and a few months later, Polymarket brought him on as an investor. So some people have pointed out that there's a lot of alignment between the Trump administration and these predictions markets.
Yeah, and speaking of politicians and the administration and everything else, I mean, presumably the people who are most advantaged when it comes to betting on this stuff would be people that work in the realm of politics or the government or different sort of departments who would know what's going on.
Right. Like, if you know that the US is about to strike Iran, you could place a bet on that and make
exactly
a ton of money. Now, there have been some suspicious examples of bets. For example, one person made $400,000 placing a bet on the eve of the U.S.'s operation to capture the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. He said he was going to get captured. He then was.
Yeah.
Which seemed a bit suspicious to people. Polymarket hasn't commented on that. Cauchy did respond by saying that its rules prohibit trading by anyone with material non-public information. On the other hand, some very clever people claim to have made money on the Maduro capture simply by building a bot to track Domino's pizza deliveries in Washington, because if more people are ordering pizza near the Pentagon, that means that people are staying up all night, like having meetings in the Pentagon, which means they might be about to do something. But there are other examples too. So last summer, an account called RicoSuave666 won more than $150,000 on Polymarket, basically betting with very suspicious accuracy on the precise timing of Israel's attacks on Iran. Israel actually arrested two men, one of whom was an army reservist, and charged them with bribery, obstruction of justice, and serious security offenses for placing bets using classified information. So what the Israeli case illustrates is that governments don't want accurate probabilities for every event to be broadcast, especially when there's classified information involved. But that is, according to the founders of these companies, what they're trying to do.
And Matt, you also mentioned Ukraine. Obviously, the war's been happening there now for 4 years since Russia invaded. Is there any evidence that there's been insider betting when it comes to that?
Yes. So there's this map developed by the Institute for the Study of War, and it is essentially a live map of the Ukraine conflict, updated hourly to reflect advances and changes in the battle lines. There was one bet in particular around the battle for Mirnohrad, which is, you know, a place in Ukraine. And there was more than $1 million in trading volume for this bet. Will Russia capture Mirnohrad? Now, at a certain point, it appears that someone with access to this map changed the battle lines, not in a way that reflected reality, but they just changed it on the map, leading people to make tons of money in this bet. And the Institute for the Study of War has said that this was an unauthorized change to the map. And this is where you get into the problematic nature of these prediction markets, is when people start to change real world events and affect real world events in order to make money on bets.
And I guess that's why we're even talking about this, and it matters, is because people can bet on outcomes. You know, here in the UK, for example, when there's an election or there's going to be one of many prime ministers that we have, people can decide to bet on who they think that might be, or who they think might win an election, but in a way that they can't affect the outcome, really. The issue here is the kind of ability to distort what's happening in the real world, because mm-hmm. you're betting on certain things which you could then affect or change, and or it might encourage people to do certain things that would make their bets come true, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that happened at the WNBA. There was this ridiculous event where people were throwing dildos onto the court at WNBA matches. And there
I feel like listening to this podcast, people must be like, what are I know, there's talking like a, about?
We're only talking about reality. This is just the world we now live in. So people are throwing dildos on the court at WNBA. Polymarket basically encouraged users to bet on like whether it would happen again. Surprise, surprise, people started tossing dildos onto the court more.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that may seem you're like a small example.
But you're incentivizing something, essentially.
Yeah. But like, what's the like dildos on the court of the future? Is it like the US striking Iran to make money on a Polymarket bet? It's all these things are now possible, right? The other thing is, there's a question as to how accurate the outcomes are and how open they are to manipulation.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, you place a bet on will Zelensky wear a suit to mm-hmm. his meeting. Okay. And this is an actual bet for
and this is after he wore his like army gear basically to this meeting where he got exactly. a real dressing down.
Why don't you wear a suit? Why don't you wear a suit? You're the highest level in this country's office and you refuse to wear a suit. Just want to see if you do you own a suit?
Dressing down quite literally, but also dressing down.
This was on Polymarket, and the trading volume was around $200 million.
Yeah.
On would Zelensky wear a suit? Now, do you remember Zelensky kind of wore a suit?
But it wasn't like a traditional suit.
Exactly. So then it becomes a debate over who wins the bet, right?
Because and who defines what a suit is?
Right. So the BBC said that he was wearing a suit, but the bet actually said no, he wasn't, and that got people to question how is the outcome of this bet actually being determined. The way it's being determined is pretty crazy and potentially manipulatable. So it goes through a crypto token called UMA, and holders of UMA basically vote on the outcome on a bet of a bet. Wow. Yeah. So they vote on the final consensus. But the weird thing about this is when you vote, you stake some of your UMA, your financial holdings on the outcome of a bet. And so you are financially incentivized to go with the majority, even if it's not factually accurate, because if you say Zelensky is wearing a suit, but the UMA consensus is that he isn't, you then lose money. So it's not a perfect system by any means.
Yeah.
And also, some have said through analysis, they've found that 95% of UMA tokens are held by large holders, which basically means that like a small number of people control this supposedly decentralized system for deciding what the true outcome of a bet is. Kalshi has its own system for adjudicating bets, but it's Polymarket that uses this UMA system. And again, it may not seem that consequential if we're just talking about Zelensky wearing a suit or not, but hundreds of millions of dollars was riding on that. And, you know, this could, there's loads and loads of bets that you could imagine where the outcome isn't clear.
And like the main reason we're talking about all of this is because it's all about this kind of world that you are very familiar with, Matt, of kind of like crypto and like stuff that feels a little bit murky and is kind of new. There also were questions about how to actually deal with it and the way that it can affect the world.
Yeah, we're sort of playing catch up to it and it's changing constantly. So now Polymarket has just announced that it's going to expand into attention markets where you can bet on what is likely to go viral. If you imagine a world, right, where you can bet on what is going to go viral and what you know about how algorithms work on social media.
Yeah, I mean, does that count as insider betting? I guess not, because it's just expert knowledge rather than like an insider who works at one of the social media companies has told me, by the way, this, we've changed our algorithm to favor X, Y, or Z.
But what you know about, what you have found about algorithms is that they favor like argumentative controversy.
Yeah,
content,
rage,
right?
Content, going to provoke a reaction.
So people are already incentivized to create and share that stuff.
So double
through things like the X
it.
Marketing, X's payment program.
Yeah.
But now they could be even further incentivized by putting a bet on it. So the divisive,
surprise, surprise, the internet becomes worse.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so another thing that you can bet on when it comes to Polymarket is measles. So you can bet on, for example, the measles cases in US by February the 28th or measles cases in the US in 2026, which feels quite dark on that. I mean, we've been talking about quite a lot of dark betting, but also very relevant to what we're talking about now, because we've seen outbreaks of measles last year in places like Texas and other areas of the US. We've then also seen them in places like Liverpool in the UK. We've seen an uptick in areas like Leeds. And then now, very recently, we've seen a surge in cases in London, specifically North London, where there have been 104 cases that have been in London, and then there's been some in the West Midlands as well. Why is this happening and how does this relate to social media? Well, it's happening for a variety of reasons, and there have been anti-vaccine sentiment or hesitancy in certain communities since vaccines became available. But what loads of medics I've spoken to, nurses, other people are saying are, look, this is about what's popping up on people's social media feeds.
We often hear about vaccine skepticism in the US where the Secretary of Health and Human Services, RFK, appears to be a vaccine skeptic himself. But is it now getting bigger in the UK?
Yeah, I think the thing that appears to be different right now is that vaccine skepticism has existed for a long time, certainly since vaccines became widely available. And we think back to the late 90s when there was this guy called Andrew Wakefield, a doctor who made these now debunked allegations about the link between the MMR vaccine and autism. That was way before social media, the dawn of social media, and that contributed to some people deciding not to vaccinate their children. He got in loads of trouble for this, and there was a period of time where everyone said, no, this is not true, do not believe this, vaccinate your kids, etc. And we should add the caveat of, and this applies to all vaccinations, that there can be side effects. There are examples of where people do come to harm or stuff happens that parents are unhappy about, but that is not, as scientific research shows us, the majority of cases, the majority of people. But what has happened since then, like the late 90s here in the UK, but actually I'd say all over the world, and social media contributes to this, is the normalization of certain rhetorics about vaccines. And, you know, when Facebook groups came to be, when you had parent groups, you had places where you know, mums and dads could talk about things like vaccinations, you started to see some of this skepticism bleeding through. And then you started to get some of these alternative health influencers who would build entire followings, discouraging people from seeking traditional medical advice. But they're a little bit more niche. They stay within their communities. They're not getting the visibility that they can now get.
And that's when COVID happened.
Yeah, exactly. So COVID happens. There's a huge amount of vaccine skepticism, understandably, because this vaccine comes out really quickly and because the world is dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And also because there are real examples of people who were harmed by the vaccination. Maybe they had blood clots. There were other side effects. And there is also genuine questions for the pharmaceutical companies and for politicians about decisions they made. But broadly, the vaccinations were effective and they were the reason that the pandemic sort of, certainly the restrictions and all of those bits came to an end in the way that they did. But that did not stop the anti-vaccine activists, some who predate the pandemic and some who sort of emerged during the pandemic, seizing upon these ideas and not just talking about COVID anymore, talking about the MMR vaccine, talking about other widely available vaccines. And now it is very hard if you basically are interested in health at all and you're seeing stuff on your feed to avoid these kinds of influences.
Is this because of social media?
Yeah. So COVID happens. And actually at that time, the companies were stricter when it came to health misinformation. Quite a lot of the big companies had rules about what you can and can't post. So if something was factually incorrect, inaccurate, maybe it would get labelled, there'd be a fact checker post, or that those kinds of posts would be removed altogether. And the kinds of people like the health misinformation influencers, a lot of them had their accounts taken down on places like Twitter or Meta's platforms, Facebook and Instagram, even on TikTok. Then if we fast forward, there's this debate about freedom of expression. Elon Musk buys X, which was called Twitter, and he says, actually, we've got this wrong in terms of how we're dealing with sort of censoring, as he called it, certain types of posts. He allows a lot of the people back on his platform, including people who spread health misinformation and including about vaccines. And he changes the rules and says, actually, you're allowed to post this stuff and we'll have community notes. We're not going to have like fact checking labels in the same way. Mark Zuckerberg, once Donald Trump is elected, follows suit at Meta. He changes some of their sort of fact checking rules, certainly in the US. And all of this results in these people, the anti-vaccine influencers, having not only a wider audience than they did before, but kind of like a more captive audience, because a lot of people have been primed during the pandemic and other things to think, oh, hang on a second, is everything not as it seems? I don't want to trust doctors and nurses. I don't want to trust the health advice beyond healthy, genuine skepticism. And so we get to this point where some of these people have, like, you know, having been basically what we would call kind of cancelled, like taken off the platforms, deplatformed, are back with a vengeance and are able to reach millions and millions of people with information that is misleading or in some cases just completely not true about vaccination.
How much responsibility do you think Spotify has in this story? Because obviously they paid hundreds of millions to Joe Rogan for his podcast, which is the most popular podcast on earth. And Joe Rogan has been accused of spreading vaccine misinformation.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to actually, if we're going kind of inside the anti-vaccine circles, to break this kind of ecosystem world down into a few different parts. So you've got like the really adamant anti-vaccine activists. So you've got people like a woman called Kate Shemarani, who I've investigated before, who built a huge platform during COVID and has continued to push stuff that is not true or is misleading about vaccinations. She would say it's not misleading. You are being duped by governments and pharmaceutical companies and everything else. And she has said that repeatedly online. You've also got people like Asim Malhotra, who is a kind of prominent doctor who has used his platform to also express skepticism about vaccinations and to suggest that they're linked to certain diseases. Again, he's really defended his views, said this is important skepticism, etc.
Didn't he speak at the Reform Party conference?
Yeah.
He said the COVID vaccine was a significant factor in the cancer diagnoses of King Charles III and the Princess of Wales.
Yeah, which is, there is no evidence to support that idea at all. And quite a lot of people found it really offensive. And at the time, Reform were very strongly criticised for having allowed him to have a platform. And actually, this gets to something important. And in a weird way, it ties in with Joe Rogan and the point you're making about Spotify, which is, you've got people who actively spread this stuff and build a platform and a following, whether they truly believe it or not. And that is another question. They would say they do. They also benefit often from spreading these ideas, whether it's on social media or in the real world, rehabilitating their image, being able to appear at party conferences or wherever else that is. Then you've got the people who allow this to happen, but they don't necessarily take an active view. Someone like Joe Rogan, hugely popular podcaster, who has allowed people to express some of these ideas that are contrary to the scientific evidence, whether it comes to vaccinations or health, on his podcast. Again, not saying that he endorses those views, but just not sufficiently challenging them in a way that, like, I would if I was interviewing someone
And
that's the issue.
That's the issue, right? Because we, as the arguably the traditional media, right, we cannot do things like that. We cannot invite someone who says things that are arguably misinformation about vaccines and not challenge them. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't go out. We might lose our jobs. Everything has to go through editorial policy, has to go through lawyers. Everything has to be fact checked rigorously. That's how media works. Does media make mistakes? Yes, of course, but it is judged by the extent to which it does not abide by those laws and that code of ethics. That does not exist in social media. And in fact, you can actually gain more of a following by not telling the truth.
Like, Rogan is an example of somebody who's come out and said, I'm not anti-vax. I just kind of want to, like, hear different people's perspectives and listen to them. Someone like RFK Jr., who is obviously holds a much more significant position when it comes to health, being the
Secretary for Health and Human Services
in the US. He has also said, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm just worried about people who have been harmed by vaccinations. And actually, when it came to the measles outbreak that happened in Texas, he did go on to actually encourage people to have vaccinations and to make informed decisions about vaccinations around MMR and measles and everything else. One thing that I think is really important here is, like, a lot of this can feel bigger than social media. Like, we're talking about someone who is holding a really important seat in office. His sort of reputation for being involved with health was made on social media.
Yeah.
Like, during the pandemic, he built a huge following by posting his skepticism about COVID-19 and vaccines sort of across the board, both on the left and the right. And a lot of these influencers, some of them started talking about health, they started talking about vaccinations, and then it became about a whole range of different things like freedom of expression, politics. I think that it's really worth us saying as well that a lot of this stuff is really emotional. Like, it's completely understandable that people want to make informed decisions about health choices for their kids and themselves. And when stuff is playing on fear, when it's playing on your emotions in that way, which is how stuff goes viral on social media because it gets reactions, it's just the perfect storm for people to then say, oh, okay, maybe I'm just not going to do this. I'm not going to go down the vaccination path because I'm worried about it. So I'll just leave it, with really serious consequences, because herd immunity requires on a certain number of people all doing it. It's not an individual choice. Well, it is, but it's not.
Okay, but how do we know that it's this disinformation and stuff on social media that's actually causing these outbreaks?
So it's always really hard to draw a concrete line between real world consequence and what's happening on social media, because often it's a little bit wiggly and there are other factors at play. So we know when it comes to some of the recent measles outbreaks, for example, the one in London, and the same applies for actually some of the ones that have happened in the US, that there are particular religious communities that have been affected where there are historically low uptake in vaccinations because there's a skepticism around them that relates to religious belief. That skepticism relating to religion has existed for a long time. So, you know, that was the case 10 years ago. It was the case 20 years ago. Obviously, the makeup of certain areas does change and evolve over time. And so you could see how certain areas might then have lower herd immunity and be more vulnerable to outbreaks. What I think is crucial here, and the key sort of tenet of evidence, there's two bits that are really important. One is that people on the front line who are talking to families affected by these outbreaks and talking to them about vaccination are increasingly hearing people say to them, I've seen this on my feed, and so therefore I don't want to have this. Or I've seen this post telling me that if I vaccinate my kid, this will happen. I would then also just say my own, like, I spend a lot of time investigating health misinformation, and I've been looking at some of the key kind of big hitters in terms of influencers who've come back onto platforms like X. This stuff is being actively recommended. These people's followings have grown, not decreased. No one's asking questions of them as though they are credible. They've got blue ticks. They've got following. They've got loads of people commenting. Why wouldn't you believe them? And often these are people who've been previously discredited, but they are persuasive and they're good at social media and they get you in. And if you look at the way they've pivoted their content, because, you know, the pandemic feels kind of a while ago now, they're focusing on other types of vaccinations like MMR, but also like whooping cough, which there are examples of where that's really seriously affected pregnant women in different places. It's a combination of all of those things which points to the fact that disinformation, anti-vaccine disinformation, is exacerbating what's happening here.